Issues, Vermont Voices, Equal Time with Anthony Polina and you.
You poisoned my sweet water. You cut down my green trees. The food you fed my children was the cause of their disease. My world is slowly falling down, and the air's not good to breathe. And those of us who care enough, we have to do something. What you gonna do about me?
Good afternoon. Welcome to Equal Time. I'm Anthony Polina. Appreciate you being here. Amy Schulenberger's here as well, right?
That's right, I'm here.
That's what I thought. We're going to talk a little bit about healthcare in a minute, or about access to healthcare, and then we're going to spend a bunch of time today talking about college, well, the cost of college in Vermont, well, everywhere, but obviously we're most concerned about the cost of college in Vermont, where the cost continues to go up, and there's a lot of different ways to look at it, but you know, one thing we do know is that in recent years, the state of Vermont's been providing less support to our state colleges, which means there's more and more of a cost shift onto the backs of students and parents, families who are trying to afford college education at a time when, you know, granted, not everybody needs to go to college, but there certainly is a recognition that for a lot of the jobs of the future, never mind the jobs of the present, college education will be helpful. So we'll get to that in a minute. First, some good news, Amy. This study came out that said, you know, we always talk about, what is it, the wage gap. Women make less than men, generally, like, what, 78 cents for every dollar that a man makes or something?
Just about that, yep.
So it doesn't seem quite fair. Anyway, this new study by Associated Press found a place in which women make more than men. And this had to do with CEOs of major corporations that women make, on a, and this is the median salary for a woman CEO.
Female?
Yes, thank you. For a female CEO makes, the median income is $11.7 million, compared to the men in the study who made only $10.5 million. Unfortunately, there were only a dozen women in the sample because that's how many women CEOs they could find who made a lot of money, but compared to the 325 who were men. But the women CEO made more than the male CEOs. But the bottom line is what they found is that median compensation for CEOs at these Standard & Poor's 500 companies was $10.8 million last year, which was about almost a 9% increase over last year. So, you know, we talk about, we argue about whether we should raise the minimum wage here in Vermont. By the time we raise it, it's going to be irrelevant anyway because of the way the cost of living goes up. And CEOs of these companies just get 9% raises whenever they, well, every year it seems just about. And I don't know, median family income, the median income of almost $11 million is not bad. They also found that on Wall Street, you know, the people we bailed out, people basically screwed up the country for a while there and continue to do so. None of them really sort of got punished or lost their job. On Wall Street, they gave out a bunch of bonuses last year, and they amounted to about $27 billion for 165,000 employees. And that was up 15% over last year. So they had a 15% increase in Wall Street employees. And they make more money, or not more money, though, their bonuses would cover the doubling of paychecks for every American who works minimum wage. And I think it would also cover the cost of, like, I don't know, like every teacher in America or something like that. It's just concentration of wealth doesn't seem to go away. And these people have no trouble affording health care, I guarantee it.
So these guys are making $11 million a year, and we can't get the minimum wage to $11 an hour. That's
right.
That's a pretty sad statement.
Or we can't ask them to pay a little bit more in taxes. You know, that's the thing, because they're doing okay. And, you know, the average in Vermont, or I presume this is true in other states, but is saving about $150,000 on their taxes since the per year since the Bush tax cuts, now Obama tax cuts, went into place. So could you ask those people to pay a little bit more? Or what I would say is hold a public hearing. Say you're going to raise taxes on these wealthy people a little bit. Call a public hearing. Let them come in and explain their position, whether or not they would agree with it or not. I don't think too many of them would come out and oppose the idea, to tell you the truth. But maybe I'm wrong. Anyway, we're going to talk for a minute or two here about healthcare with Donna Sutton Fay, who is the an organizer with the Vermont Citizens Campaign for Healthcare Security. If I think I got the name not quite right, how are you doing, Donna?
Good. How are you?
Good. So the reason why we just wanted to talk is we just passed one deadline. This is about moving into the healthcare exchange, and we just passed one deadline. Which, and I'm saying this as a definitive, but I'm really asking you this as a question: are we all who are supposed to be in the exchange now, including these folks who are on Catamount and VHAP, which is most of the population we just wanted to talk about for a minute? I know the deadline is passed, so just tell us a little bit about where we are at.
Well, you're right. The deadline was May 31st for people who were in VHAP and Catamount to get enrolled in a new health insurance plan through the exchange, Vermont Health Connect. That doesn't apply, however, to anybody who's eligible for Medicaid or Dr. Dinosaur. They can enroll anytime. The open enrollment deadlines don't apply to them. So I have not seen sort of the latest numbers about how many people may have been in VHAP and Catamount who didn't, you know, get enrolled in new coverage. I know the state was working hard to reach all of those people. So I'm, you know, certainly very hopeful that most everyone did know about the deadline and, you know, were able to enroll if they wanted to do that.
So people who are Medicaid eligible still have time? Is that
people who are eligible for Medicaid and Dr. Dinosaur can enroll whenever they want. There's no enrollment period for Medicaid and Dr. Dinosaur. And just to remind people, eligibility for Medicaid expanded in January when Vermont Health Connect started. So many, many more Vermonters are eligible for Medicaid now than used to be. And in fact, about 80% of the people who were in VHAP became Medicaid eligible. So, you know, people should, you know, call you know, the state or call a navigator organization, you know, to get the details on that, because it's never too late to enroll in Medicaid.
Well, actually, that's what I wanted to add. Well, I was going to ask you whether or not people can actually get through these days. I mean, I haven't followed it that closely in the last couple of weeks, and we all remember when there were serious problems with navigating through the exchange. I'm just wondering what your take is on that at this point.
Yeah, well, certainly the you know, Vermont Health Connect web portal works much, much more smoothly. It's not perfect, and the state's still working on making some changes, but it's working, you know, far, far better. People are, I think, generally able to get through to the customer call center. There were, you know, as you said, long, long wait times earlier. But I know when I've called, I've gotten through almost immediately, and we are not hearing from people now that they're not able to get through. So that has vastly improved.
But that depends on where you set the bar, right? Vastly improved from where it was is good, but
it's still, I mean, I know when I've called, you know, compared to, you know, sort of in the middle of open enrollment where sometimes I just hung up because I couldn't get through. Now when I call, you know, I get to a live person within, you know, a minute or so. So it's definitely much, much better, and we're not hearing from Vermonters that they're not able to get through.
So I wanted to ask you also about what has happened in terms of the controversy, I guess I would say, of the fact that folks who were, and the reason why I'm asking this in part is I still hear from people about this, whether it's accurate or not, and I've actually heard from some people last week about it, about people who are on VHAP or Catamount who have gone into the exchange and have seen their costs go up. I mean, is that accurate, or what's the? I know there was a big debate about that, and we tried to hold them harmless. I'm just wondering how it all shook out.
Well, the legislature actually, I don't think, ultimately did decide to try to hold people harmless. And how people in VHAP and Catamount were affected, you know, varies with everyone's individual circumstances. For those people who became eligible for Medicaid, they're in a far better position than they were. But for people who are in, you know, not eligible for Medicaid or in one of the private Blue Cross Blue Shield or MVP plans, their premiums may not be too much different than they were in Catamount, but certainly the out-of-pocket costs they have can be quite substantially higher, you know, co-payments, deductibles.
Yeah, and that's what I've been hearing
those,
a lot.
Those kinds of things are quite a bit higher for many people, if not most, than they were in Catamount.
Because that's what I've heard about mostly from people lately who have found that their prescription drug copays, particularly, have gone up a lot. And they were just, I think you're right that ultimately the cost will maybe lower over the course of a year. But I think it's sometimes a little bit of a shock for people when they see their out of pockets go up, because that's the part they're used to seeing, or used to not. You know, that's, you know, you pay your premium whether you like it or not. And then it's that when you put your hand in the pocket to pay those copays,
right,
is when you really realize what's going on.
Right. In Catamount, while it did have, you know, copayments and deductibles, they were very low compared to what most people have in the exchange. And so it is, you know, it is of concern for sure, for people having to pay, obviously, but also for those of us who are trying to make sure health care is affordable.
So my understanding, I'm going to let you go after this, and I know this is not necessarily your thing, but we're hearing that rates are going to go up in the exchange, and just wondering, I mean, maybe that's to be expected as long as we, you know, change the cost curve over time, but I'm presuming then that the folks from Catamount and VHAP will also see their premiums go up as well?
I expect that will be, you know, the case, yes. I don't think, because of the way the exchanges work, I think the out-of-pocket costs are not going to change. It's going to be, I mean, in July 1st when the new plans start, I believe it will be the premiums. And if they are, as everyone's predicting, will go up, which they usually do, people will be paying, you know, more in premiums, you know, sort of depending on what the Green Mountain Care Board decides in terms of what rate increases it will allow. So, you know, and a lot of people will be watching that very closely.
But ultimately, now you're the Vermont Campaign for Healthcare Security, and you've advocated for universal health care, lower costs, et cetera.
Right.
So where are we at now in terms of, you know, from your point of view, are we heading down the right path? Or?
Well,
I know it's hard to see what's around the corner, right?
Well, I think, you know, we had to do the exchange. You know, it's required by the Affordable Care Act. I don't think Vermont would have chosen to do that, you know, otherwise. So we do have to live with the exchange. But the exchange, costs in the exchange are unaffordable for most people. And it is based on a private insurance marketplace. And so ultimately, for coverage to be affordable coverage to be available to everybody in Vermont, I do think we're going to have, we need to move towards more public financing for healthcare. If you look at Dr. Dinosaur as an example, I mean, it's an extremely successful program. You know, for kids, it's been in place for quite a long time. You know, everyone accepts that as a publicly financed healthcare program for kids. And it can certainly, you know, serve as a model for something we could do, you know, for adults. But as long as we, you know, maintain the exchange based on the private market, you know, we're going to be, you know, sort of stuck with out-of-pocket costs and premiums that are unaffordable for a lot of people, even with the subsidies that are in place, you know, both from the on the federal level and the state level.
So these folks who are still need to get into the exchange, they should call a navigator. Is that still the best way to do it, or what would you
suggest? They can call a navigator organization, and there's a list on the Vermont Health Connect website. People can also apply over the phone by calling the call center, but navigators are listed by county, so they could look up their county and call somebody, you know, to get some help, get some advice about what their options are at this point. Some people still can enroll, even though we're past the open enrollment deadline. You know, for example, people who might lose their insurance because they've lost their job, or young adults who are, you know, aging off their parents' plan, people who get married or have, you know,
yeah, I
a
always
child
thought that
to adopt a child, they can all enroll now, even though we're past the open enrollment.
I always thought it was kind of a strange thing that there would be like a deadline, like you got to buy your insurance by this time or you don't get it. That just seems so strange to me.
Well, that's one of the fundamental problems with the exchange, is that you know, I mean, the concept of open enrollment is a private insurance concept. You know, like with Dr. Dinosaur and Medicaid, there's no deadline by which you can enroll. You can enroll at any point during the year, which is much more conducive to people getting coverage and keeping coverage than having, you know, deadlines set where if you miss the deadline, you might be out of luck for the rest of the year.
It's very strange. Donna, thanks a lot for taking the time. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Have a good afternoon.
Thank you. It's Donna Sutton Fay with the Vermont Campaign for Healthcare Security. I like her point about Dr. Dinosaur covering all our kids. Nobody's ever accused us of being like a socialist state because we provide publicly funded health care for kids.
That's right, and I think it's really important to provide that care. We all know that it helps the kids get off to a better start, and it would help the adults too.
So we take care. We do a pretty good job with the kids. We do a very good job with kids. We do a pretty good job with older folks, meaning Medicare does anyway. It's just all the rest of us in between that kind of get screwed in the process. Not so fair. So another thing in terms of the premiums going up in healthcare, and what we want to talk about is colleges. And there's something that gets underfunded in Vermont on a pretty regular basis. We seem to be willing and able to just ignore the need to fund our state colleges, regardless of how important they are to Vermonters. So we're going to talk a little bit with Linda Olson. Linda is a professor down at Castleton State College. She's also the president of the VSC, Vermont State College Faculty Federation. Hi, Linda. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. So first, tell us what the VSC Faculty Federation is, and tell us what you teach so we'll have a sense of who we're talking to.
Sure. The VSC, the Vermont State College Faculty Federation, is the faculty union for the state system. So I represent all four campuses that have bargaining unit members at them. And at Castleton, I am a professor of sociology, and I also teach women's and gender studies.
So, unfortunately, then you're not part of this whole STEM thing, right? You're not really part of the future.
I'm not, actually. Apparently, I'm not part of the future. And I'd like to, you know, change that conversation to, of course, include the importance of social sciences into that conversation as well.
You don't think we should only be, like, supporting or reducing tuition for people who are good in math and science?
No, because I think that really does ignore the fact that so many of our students are doing very important things for the state of Vermont. Educators, for example, people who go on to teach, social workers. They're all serving important functions and services for the state of Vermont, and they should have the same benefits that those in the STEM areas have as well.
Well, you don't think that perhaps maybe somebody gets really good at math and science, gets one of these STEM scholarships or whatever they are. We can talk about more what they are in a minute. Where you pay your tuition, you go to college, get a degree in one of these science, math, engineering, technology.
Technology, engineering, and math. I think.
And then you have to pay for college.
Uh-huh.
You got to major in one of those. You got to get a job. And you got to live in Vermont doing that job for a while, and then the state is willing to pay back some of your college education if you're still around by then, and which I don't think is necessarily the best way to go about trying to encourage formal college education.
No.
But it also means you might have a lot of really qualified mathematicians who don't know what to do with the numbers.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So tell us a little bit about your feeling about the level funding of state colleges this year, and then we'll talk about reclaiming the promise.
Okay. All right. Well, I don't know how many of your listeners are aware that Vermont currently ranks either 49th or 50th in terms of state support for higher education, depending upon which figure you look at. So that means we give the least amount of funding for higher education or the second least amount of funding for higher education. No matter which way you slice and dice it, it's really not a very good place to be. And it also means that our students are paying one of the highest tuitions in the country for public higher education, which I think is a real disservice to our students who then graduate with more debt on average than students from other states as well. So I think we're sort of setting our students up for disaster, especially if they want to stay and work in Vermont, where, you know, the cost of living might be lower than other places, but so is the income. So paying back an incredible amount of student debt really sets them up for failure, and I would really like to see that change for our students.
Yeah, we do have one of the highest debt-to-income ratios, I think is what it's called.
Yeah, right, exactly. Exactly. And if you look at, you know, the VSC figures anyway, we have consistently, and this is true for UVM as well, we have consistently stopped paying for higher education. So we went from a
We stopped paying?
We reduced the amount. Every year we reduced the amount we give to higher education or level funded it. So we currently pay about 18% of the amount for the VSC comes from state appropriations. And in the past, that was closer to 50%. So it's been greatly reduced over the years, which means that money has got to come from somewhere. And unfortunately, it tends to come from student tuition. So we're charging our students more and more to make up the difference. And my fear is not only that we're charging our students an incredible amount in terms of tuition, but also that we have to reduce the quality, ultimately, of the education we provide if we don't get more state support for higher education.
Yeah. And then there's this other side of it, which is that enrollment is decreasing in the state colleges as well, which
right.
the chancellor has testified to in the state mm-hmm. house this year. And I think that compounds the problem. The tuition's going up, the enrollment's going down, the students who are left to go there are paying even more.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's I don't think it's a coincidence that we have one of the highest rates of high school graduation in the state of Vermont, but one of the lowest rates of going on to college. I think that affordability is definitely the most significant issue playing into that deck of cards, I guess you could say.
Yeah, I wonder how much those two things are directly tied. And when we were debating, we were debating whether or not how to fund the state colleges in the Senate this year. I hesitate because I may have been the only one actually debating if we were talking about it. And one of the comments that other folks made who were justifying, I don't want to put it this way, they were not justifying the lack of funding. Nobody really justifies, but they were justifying the lack of additional funding, I guess, as I would put it.
Mm-hmm.
They said, the real problem is that there's too many empty desks at the state colleges, and, you know, that's the problem, meaning there's not enough students, so we're not getting enough revenue. We're not selling enough seats in a way, which, as Amy said, it's somewhat true that enrollment is going down. But
right.
I said, well, maybe enrollment's going down because it's expensive. You know, I used to go to concerts, you know, and you'd pay $10 to see a couple of bands and they'd be full. And now you want to go to a concert and it's going to cost you $300. And so you don't go. And so there's an empty seat there. I mean, it seems to me like the two are tied.
Yeah, I agree. Because if you look at the demographic trends, certainly that population is becoming smaller of students who are going on, you know, high school students who would be able to go on to college. That number is smaller. Just demographically, it's smaller. But 70% of those students are still deciding not to go on to college. So why aren't we tapping into that 70%? And I think the affordability issue is a significant one there.
Do you have any idea when people, you know, decide that they can't afford to go to college? Like, my impression, I've been told by these people who are smarter than I am about this stuff, that generally they say that by the time a kid's in ninth or ninth grade or mm-hmm. so, they have figured out whether they're going to go to college or not.
Yeah.
And so if in ninth grade you figure out or you understand from your parents you can't afford to go to college, that might impact how hard you study while you're, like, mm-hmm. in high school. You get this feeling of hopelessness.
Yeah. Well, research does show that usually that decision is made in junior high or the first couple years of high school, whether or not they're going on to college. So there is some support for that. And we can definitely do a better job at reaching out to those students, and especially first-generation students, and showing them that it is possible to go on to college, even if their parents didn't. But we need to, I mean, just the nuts and bolts of it, we need to combine that with an affordable college. You know, we need to give them something that their parents or they can actually pay for. So I think both have to go hand in hand again.
I think that's right, because I think if you do decide you want to go to college, you're going to be probably taking different classes in high school,
mm-hmm.
which means you might have a higher, load of homework and studying, which might mean you can't get a job after high school or, a job after school or something like that, because you're more focused on your studies. Whereas if you decide not to go into college, you might have a lighter load. You might be starting your part-time work after school. You might be leaving class early to go to a job, depending on, you know, what year you're in your high school.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I think if we're talking about, well, not on the other hand, on the same hand, if we're talking about trying to keep young people in the state of Vermont, it would make sense to allow them to be able to afford to go to college here, because a lot of kids leave and go to college and then they don't come back. So I think that has a big impact on this whole question. I think it was, what's the name, Chancellor Donovan, might have been him. I don't have it in front of me, but sort of was saying something which I really agree with. He said, you know, we lament people, young people leaving the state of Vermont, and we lament the problems that we have developing a, you know, workforce for the future, and we lament what's going on in our economy with, you know, low median family income and whatnot, and, you know, all of that is tied to the opportunity to get a college education. And I think that, you know, when we do not fund the colleges, we're sort of really saying to a lot of young people, not only do we not care about whether or not you get a college education, but we frankly don't even care if you stick around or not.
Yeah. I think that we still have a mindset that college is the privilege of the elites, that only those who come from wealthy families should have the right to go to college. And that really, that's no longer the case. I mean, to make it to a middle-class existence, or even a lower-middle-class existence, you need to have some college background. And it's really unfair that we've decided that those students from low-income families who maybe don't have parents who graduated from college, that we've decided that they're not worthy of the same opportunities as those from more privileged families.
Do you think that it's really been a decision, Linda, though, or just sort of an erosion? I mean, one of the things that I've learned looking at this issue is that it's almost like a sin of omission, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah.
It's not that anybody says, how can we keep low-income students from going to college? It's more that
it's not a plan.
We sort of wring our hands and say, oh, there's not enough money to go around, and so we have to choose this over this. And I think that's an ongoing debate every year with the budget, and we're constantly telling this story that we don't have enough.
Yeah.
And so some people have to lose.
Well, I think you're right, Amy. I think it hasn't been, you know, an intentional thing. But at the same time, I think the way they think about higher education as being something that, you know, not everybody needs and that those who can afford will go, I think that mindset has to change. And we have to realize that putting an investment in higher education, public higher education, affordable public higher education, is ultimately putting an investment in Vermont. If we can get those students to get that higher education, they're going to turn around and, you know, become workers in Vermont. They're going to raise their families here. They're going to pay taxes here. So that it is an investment in the future, just like we seem to understand that K through 12 support is an investment in the future. We understand that, and I think we just need to, you know, push that back a little bit and make it K through 16 investment is an investment in the future.
Well, I'm going to disagree for a second, only in the way both you and both Linda and Amy phrased what you said, because I think it is or has been sort of a conscious choice that we've made. Not we meaning Vermonters, but I think we meaning legislators and governors have looked at a budget, you know, within the State House, and we looked at the budget this year, and I looked at the budget when it finally came to the Senate floor, and it said, you know, funding for state colleges, and I forget the number, it's like $24 million or something like that, not very much. And you look across the lines, and it was like last year, this year, and next year, and it was all the same. So I think it is, you know, I always like to remind people that everything that we're talking about when we're talking about issues like this, whether it's more people living in poverty or the loss of family farms or the underfunding of colleges, it is a conscious choice. I mean, we might say, well, we don't have the money, which is really a whole other argument, because I don't believe we don't have the money. I think we choose not to access the money. But anyway, I just want to put that out there. I think that, you know, we make choices. You know, this year we decided to set aside $5 million in case some large businesses or large business decides to threaten to leave the state. We're going to, like, I don't know what to call it. We're going to entice them to stay by offering them $5 million. But we decided not to put $5 million into our state colleges. So anyway, I don't want to ramble on. It's just that I do think it's a choice that we make. And I remember one time, while I'm rambling on, I had a conversation with then-Governor Howard Dean, and I said to him, you know, like, what's the – I'm paraphrasing here, but I said, so, Howard, what's the deal? You know, like, why do we continue to underfund our colleges, and why do we give them less support than any other state? And he said something like, well, it happened during the recession when we just couldn't fund them or something like that, and we've never been able to dig ourselves out of that hole. And I was like, well, you know, it still was a choice we made during the recession, what to fund and what not to fund. And anyway, I think it's important to keep in mind that we could change this direction if we choose to do it, and it is about choices that we make.
I actually agree with you, Anthony, and I think the point I was trying to make is that the first choice we make is to say we don't have enough.
Right.
And I think, you know, you and others have pointed out that there is enough here in Vermont. Mm. We could make the choice to put some more money into public higher education and also other things that really need to be funded. But we always start with the choice to say there's not enough to go around. And so who is going to pay that price?
Right. Well, it's that whole thing. I'm sorry, Linda, were you going to say something?
I was just going to say, I actually agree with you as well that we could do a better job at looking what we do choose to support. And also, I think we just really need to think of the worth of higher education to the state of Vermont, not just to the students who get it, but to the state of Vermont. And I do think we need to really pound that message home that when you invest in higher education, you are investing in Vermont. And maybe they'll see higher education as more of a priority than they have for the past, 30-odd years.
Linda Olson is a professor down at Castleton State College and is the president of the Vermont State College Faculty Federation. We're going to take a commercial break. When we come back, we'll continue the conversation. I forgot to tell you earlier that there are phone numbers you could call. Amy, you were supposed to remind us about this kind of stuff. 244-1777 or 1-877-291-8255. If you're happy with the way we're funding our colleges, please let us know. We'd like to know who out there thinks we're doing the right thing by having the most expensive state colleges in the country. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
There's milk and lots more at the Vermont Dairy Festival June 5th through the 8th. A petting zoo, kids rides, a parade on Saturday morning, and a free concert Sunday afternoon with Jamie Lee Thurston on the People's Trust Bandstand. It's easy to find right in the middle of downtown Enosburg Falls. So make plans to visit the Vermont Dairy Festival June 5th through the 8th. Brought to you by the Franklin County Dairy Promotion Board and the Enosburg Falls Lions Club. See you there.
Caesar has arrived! It's the new Caesar's Instant Ticket from the Vermont Lottery. Win up to $50,000 instantly. Plus, enter to win one of 6 VIP trips to Caesar's Palace Las Vegas, including airfare, 5 days and 4 nights at luxurious Caesar's Palace. Spending money. Plus, trip winners can win up to $100,000 at the exclusive Tri-State Caesar's Jackpot Party. The new Caesar's Ticket. Fun reigns supreme. Please play responsibly.
Do you have difficulty reading, writing, or doing basic math? You're not alone. About 35,000 adults and teens in Vermont have low literacy skills. Each year, hundreds of these people decide to build their academic skills by enrolling at Central Vermont Adult Basic Education. CVABE provides free, confidential instruction for adults and teens living in Washington, Orange, and Lamoille counties. Some are learning basic reading or math for the first time. Others are gaining education to earn a high school credential or to secure a job. Many residents are reaching new goals through literacy. It all begins by taking the first step. To learn more about CVABE's free education programs, call 802-476-4588. CVABE proudly thanks Vermont's banks and credit unions for their leadership in our Investing in Literacy campaign.
Here we are back again. This is Amy Schollenberger, and I'm here with Anthony Polina and Linda Olson from the Vermont State Colleges Faculty Federation. And we've been talking about the cost of public higher education here in Vermont. And I wanted to mention two studies that just came out in May and June, one from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities called States Are Still Funding Higher Education Below Pre-Recession Levels. Anthony just pointed out that even back when Governor Dean was around, he was blaming the recession on the lower funding of the higher education in Vermont. And this study is really interesting to read. It's basically saying that across the country, that's the excuse. And Vermont is not catching up. Many other states are not catching up. And we need to do something more about that. there's another study that's pretty interesting, too. It's called Borrowing Against the Future. And this one says that one of the big problems that's happening is that both private and public colleges are actually borrowing money. And this is one of the things that is increasing the costs. And Vermont is in the 95th percentile for percentage increases in interest spending.
That's pretty amazing, actually, when you think about it. Colleges borrow. It's like, you know, we talk about families going into debt, and now we're seeing colleges go into debt because governments or the public are not willing to provide them with the income they need, with the revenue they need.
That's right, and we just saw the bond rating go down here in Vermont for the Vermont State Colleges. And so these two things are interesting to read. These studies, you can find them online, and I think they're two of the things that will be talked about in this new committee that is starting up that Linda is a member of, that was created from a bill that Anthony Polina sponsored called S-40. Linda, do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, first I want to thank Senator Polina for sponsoring this bill, because it brings all of the interested parties to the same table, so we can at least have a discussion about ways that we can, you know, turn the tide on this lack of support for higher education. But S-40 has several goals, and one of them is to lower student and family costs and debt so that UVM and VSE are more affordable for Vermont students. We also want to return to the 1980 level of state support for higher education, which, as I said, was around 50% of our budget, and now it's currently under 18% of our budget. And we also want to work with VSAC on the portability issue and see what we can do in terms of making higher education affordable on all levels, including looking at where we spend our money within the VSC and UVM to see if there's better ways that we can spend our very limited allocations so that students benefit the most. So more money maybe towards instructional costs than administrative costs or other areas.
Well, it was interesting how it took, I don't know, Amy might remember this too, it took a couple of years to pass a bill, S-40, that basically says we're going to try to figure this out, which to me goes back to the conversation we're having about choices, where I think there was a resistance to even taking this on because, as Amy said about the colleges being underfunded during the recession, how we haven't dug, you know, we dig a big hole by continuing to underfund things, then it seems so formidable to, like, how are we ever going to fix this because we let it get so bad. And it was just interesting that it took so long to get the legislature to agree to even take on the question of looking at the problem. But the important thing is that the bill actually does commit the state to returning to that 1980 ratio of funding. And I just want listeners to understand what we're talking about is that in 1980, half of the revenue from the state colleges came from the state. These are public institutions. They, you know, get supported by public dollars. In fact, that's what the law setting up the state colleges said, that they should be supported. What was it?
Whole or insubstantial part.
Yeah.
Right, which we're not doing. I mean, if we had done that kindergarten through 12th grade, we'd be in big trouble for not supporting them publicly. So the important thing is we did make the commitment in the bill to going back to that ratio of funding, which I think would be a good thing to do.
So this committee is having their first meeting on Thursday this week, Linda, and you're having six meetings. And I wanted to hear you talk a little bit about the Reclaim the Promise campaign that the faculty, Fed, and United Academics participated in, and how that helped to push the bill over the finish line in the State House.
Well, I think our intent with that bill, with the campaign, the Reclaim the Promise campaign, was to show the value of higher education, what I've been talking about. And I think what we attempted to do was show legislators very clearly that the work that we do in the VSC and UVM is an asset to the state and needs to be supported as such. But I think the messengers of our Reclaim the Promise were really the ones who caused legislators to listen, and that was our students. They came out in droves to really talk about, you know, the difficulties they have paying for tuition, what they hope to do after graduation, and how those plans may not include staying in Vermont because they may not be able to afford to because of the student loan debt they've accumulated, what kinds of work they currently do even as students. And also some alumni came out and said, this is what the value of higher education in Vermont has meant to me, and this is what I now do for the state of Vermont. So the Reclaim the Promise, the term comes from AFT National, but it really applies to us. As Anthony was just talking about, the enacting legislation in 1961 said that the state would support the VSC in whole or substantial part, and we're asking them to honor that promise with this initiative. And I think we did make some headroads with that. I think people started to listen, especially when students started giving their message.
And it makes me think that, you know, we fund our public education with income sensitivity. So in rounding off, like, nobody pays more than like 2% of their income mm-hmm. property
yeah.
taxes. And then if you want to send your kid to Johnson State College, the average Vermonter is going to pay like 30% of their income to send their kids to college. It's really... It's like we just, you know, we really, as you mentioned before, Linda, we do a really good job of getting people to graduate from high school. Then we kind of toss them aside and say,
yeah.
Okay, now the rest is up to you. We're not going to support the colleges in a way that makes them affordable for you. But I also, you know, one thing I want to make sure that we mention or that you respond to, Linda, is something that I hear from naysayers somewhat on this question of increasing funding for state colleges is that, you know, the colleges, the way it's often phrased as well, if you want to talk about giving more money to colleges, then the colleges have to talk about making sure that they're, like, being, I don't know, what efficient, you know, whatever, and, like, people want to make sure that you're not...
Frugal,
right? Mm-hmm. The whole austerity thing. I mean, is there a way to respond to that, or is it totally unnecessary to respond to that? I mean, I do hear it from people who say, this is the way they say it. They say, well, if you want to look at how we should increase funding, we should look at how the colleges could cut costs. That's I think, the way that it's often phrased.
Well, I think, in fairness, we should look at where our resources are allocated. But the reality is our resources are so limited. I don't think any element of the colleges is being overly... is spending way too much beyond what we should. But I think we should see where our resources are going. Are they going towards instructional costs that ultimately help the students, or are they not? And we should have that conversation. There's nothing wrong with that conversation. And I think we could do better on that level. But overall, we get so little from the state, we're hardly being, you know,
you're not wasting the money.
Yeah, exactly. We don't have the resources to do that. I mean, if you compare our salaries for faculty and staff to the national averages, we're below. But if you compare our salaries for administrators, we're below there, too. So it's not like anybody's making money hand over fist. Could we do better? Probably. Yeah, we could do better. And that's something we should talk about during the study group. And that's one of the things on the table in the study group. And I hope we do have that conversation. But overall, we don't have the resources to be spending money crazily.
And I know you don't want to go down this road, but when you mentioned administrative salaries, it makes me think about UVM a little bit. And
mm-hmm.
don't they have like 50 different administrators who make over a bazillion dollars?
Anyone makes over a bazillion dollars. That might be exaggerating a little bit.
I'm not trying to make you. I mean, it's not your...
I don't know UVM as well as VSC since I'm part of the VSC. I do know there are some administrators who make a lot of money at UVM, but I can't really speak to that. So I think we can look into that. I think it's something we need to address.
Could you also, and again, I don't know if you have an answer to what I'm about to ask you, and it's okay if you don't, but around VSAC.
Mm-hmm.
People complain, or, well, coloring your answer before I even ask the question. VSAC allows you can borrow money from the Vermont Student Assistance Corporation and then go to college in Minnesota, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people have mixed feelings about that. I'm just wondering what your take, if anything, is on the idea of VSAC only funding people who stay in Vermont. Or I'm just wondering if you've thought about that at all.
Yeah, I've thought about that a lot, actually, because we, and that is one of the issues that's included in S-40 as well, and I'm very happy about that. We are one of two states that has completely unrestricted portability, which means we don't have any restrictions on where our state dollars can go. They can go out of state. And approximately 26% of VSAC's resources go out of state. I think that it's okay to have a portability agreement with other states, but I don't know that I agree with that totally unrestricted portability. And maybe we should look at that and see whether or not we could spend our resources better by only agreeing to have portability agreements with states that agree to have portability agreements with us, you know, the reciprocal relationship. I think that's something we definitely need to look into. And I know that was a big issue with the students who got involved with the Vermont Student Union, which is a statewide group that's really looking at the student debt level in Vermont. So I think we should really have an honest conversation about whether or not that's the best way to spend our resources.
Well, I'm glad I asked you. I went through this whole debate for the last 3 years, and I never really was made clear that only two states have this kind of open-ended thing. Mm-hmm. I knew that there were a lot of money going to other states, but I didn't realize that other states restricted it as much or so much.
Yeah, some states require a reciprocal agreement with the state. So if I can take my money to Massachusetts, then Massachusetts has to be giving money back to Vermont. That's how it would work in some of the other states.
So, Linda, how does this, if at all, affect the students, in terms of are they aware of what's going on? I know some of them obviously got involved in the legislative debate, but I mean, in general, on campus, I just wonder whether sort of some of this, the economic issues, are sort of translated into how kids feel about what's going on at the colleges.
I think that the students are very aware of it. They might not have a clear sense of how bad it is in Vermont in terms of state support for higher education, but they know they're struggling. And I think you can see that with the Vermont Student Union. The students who have gotten involved in that have been really vocal about the difficulties the student debt represents for them. And what I find most interesting about the students who were really active and really helped to push S-40 through and will probably play a role on the study group to a degree, that those students will probably never see a benefit from the work that they do. And to me, that says that they are committed enough to higher education in Vermont that they're willing to work on something that they will never see a direct benefit from. And I think that's saying something.
Yeah, actually, I think that's saying a lot.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Linda. And we should mention that there will be two students on the study committee,
right,
one each from UVM and the Vermont State Colleges, and as well as two faculty members, one from the state colleges and one from UVM. You're obviously the state college rep. Do you want to talk a little bit about the UVM representative?
The UVM representative will be my like person at UVM. So she's the president of the United Academics, and her name is Denise Youngblood, and she'll be involved in the conversations as well. But this is clearly something that both of us benefit from having this kind of conversation, because both UVM and the Vermont State Colleges have suffered from the lack of state support. There's no getting around that issue.
What are we going to do about this? I hate to put it that way, but, to really get back to, I think we need to do something. I sponsored the bill that is created in this conversation, but, I mean, is there anything particularly creative, or, I mean, have you thought about proposals to put on the table, or is it just, if it's okay with me, if it's just about coming up with more money, but I'm just wondering whether you got something up your sleeve that you think is going to appeal to people, or are you just going to wait and see what happens?
It's early for me to have something up my sleeve at this point, but I have been looking into different ideas. I really think this is an opportunity to do something really innovative in a state that really can do something really innovative because we're so small. For example, I'm looking into this research that was done on making higher education free for the first 2 years and how you would do that in a state. And that would be great if we could institute something like that. So I think there are plenty of plans out there, including the Pay It Forward plan, which I'm not a fan of, but other plans which have potential. And I think this is the time where we get everybody who has an expertise in this area at the table so we can just really hash it out and see if we can come up with something to help our students and to help our colleges.
One of the things I really liked about the way the bill was structured is that this committee is part of the pre-K to 16 council, which was established to look at the full breadth of education, public education in Vermont. And I really like that it's being put in as a whole range from pre-kindergarten all the way up to college. And even though this committee is really focused on higher education, I think it's important to think about it right from birth all the way up and to think about ways to fund the whole scheme. As Anthony was saying, we put a lot of focus on K to 12. And just like public higher education, our early education is also underfunded, mm-hmm. publicly speaking. So I think this is a really good committee to have, and I'm glad it's part of this council.
Yeah, I think, Amy, you're exactly right, because I think early childhood education before, you know, kindergarten and higher education in the state of Vermont has largely been neglected. And I think it's time that we discuss both those issues. And it's interesting that we have S-40 that came out this year and also the early childhood educator bill that was enacted this year as well. So I'm looking forward to seeing education being presented not just as K through 12, but as much more than that.
Linda, thanks a lot for taking the time, and not just to talk to us, but for taking the time to be on the S-40 committee and doing the work that you need to do to try to sort of move us forward in a more positive way in this question. And I think people do realize more and more how important it is that we adequately fund colleges. I think it's one of those issues that is beginning to pop up more and more in conversations with people who are beginning to understand that if we want to survive, meaning as a state, not necessarily just as individuals, but as a state in this economy in the future, that we got to do something to make sure that people are adequately educated. And again, not everybody needs to go to college, but clearly there's a lot of jobs we're looking at do involve the need for a college education of some sort or another. So I appreciate your commitment.
Well, thank you for your support as well.
I would just like to remind people that this committee meeting on Thursday is open to the public. If you want to go and watch the committee meeting, it's Thursday at 1 o'clock in Room 10 at the State House.
Thanks a lot, Linda. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Linda Olson, again, is a professor at Castleton State and president of the Faculty Federation of the Vermont State Colleges. Doesn't teach science, math, or engineering. He's got to give her credit for still having a job doing it. Artie didn't take any of those things, although he is an engineer, so I shouldn't say that. Somebody turns the dials here at WDEV.
Well, I was a philosophy major. So.
Well, I was a political science major, so there we go. We're all working in our field.
At least you have science.
Well, that's true. It is a science, an art and a science. You know, one thing I just want to mention is that earlier we started the show by mentioning the CEO salaries and whatnot, sort of tongue-in-cheek, but the increasing inequality relates really directly to what we're talking about with colleges, because if middle-income, lower-income, you know, regular working families can't afford to send their kids to college, then they're not as prepared for those jobs that we're talking about. So you end up with this cycle where only people who have more money can go to college, so they come out better prepared for those higher-paying jobs. You know, so you create this cycle where more you're concentrating wealth, more and more wealth and opportunity, because one of the issues with inequality is the lack of opportunity that there is now to move up the social ladder, economic ladder, I guess. So direct relationship, and we have seen the income of wealthy Vermonters go up a lot more than working class Vermonters, and it means they're the ones who can afford to go to college. And I don't know, when you relate it to early ed, is it just that college kids aren't as cute as little kids? And
well, I don't think it's that so much. I think it's just that we know that both early education and college can really be determining factors in whether you get a chance to have a middle-class life or not. I think if you don't get off to a good start, your chances are, you know, they get lower as you go. And if you get all the way to finish high school, but then you don't have the opportunity to go to college, you know, that can really inhibit your opportunities as well, as you were just saying.
And I think part of it is that you get discouraged halfway through high school, or as Linda said, she said middle school, right, or junior high.
That's right.
Kids get a pretty good idea of whether or not they can afford to go to college. And I really do think it could be pretty demoralizing to find out you can't. And yet, for the state of Vermont to worry about young people staying in the state and supposedly worrying about keeping, you know, jobs here and whatnot, I shouldn't say supposedly, we are concerned about that. But to then ignore one of the most important pieces of that whole puzzle just seems, I don't know, just unfathomable to me. But I think we've dug such a big hole that now people don't know what to do about it.
Yeah, and I think it's worth saying that like 80% of the students that go to Vermont State Colleges stay here.
So you're going to stay here. You'll be back next Monday?
I'll be back next Monday.
Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Locally Owned and Operated 96.1 WDEV, FM in Warren, FM 96.5 in Barrie, and AM 550 WDEV, Waterbury, Montpelier.
AP Radio News. I'm Tim McGuire.